centuries ago, shipping was a much riskier business to be in. And not just because you were generally sailing around in a small wooden vessel that was almost entirely at the mercy of the weather. If you'd invested your money into the ship and or its cargo, you were depending on that ship returning with a profitable amount of goods to ensure your own continued livelihood. Since, although investing in these things was within the reach of somewhat more of the population than it is today, it still represented a massive, potentially total financial risk to almost anyone involved. More than one fairly wealthy family was impoverished when a particularly promising ship or two was sunk, seized, or otherwise lost. Thus, in the mid-14th century, we see the rise of what can be roughly described as modern maritime insurance, the basic principle being quite simple. The ship and its cargo are assigned an agreed value, and then depending on the risk perceived to be involved in the transportation of that cargo, a certain percentage of the value of the vessel, the cargo, or both, depending on what you're insuring, would be paid to the insurance company, the insuring individual, the insuring club, or whatever the insuring entity happened to be. If the ship then made it back safely, then this money was retained by the insurance company and the owners of the ship and or cargo would recover the cost of the insurance from their profits. But if the ship or cargo was wholly or partially lost or damaged, then the insurance company would pay them the agreed sum. Of course, for the insurers, this meant they had to insure many ships and cargoes so that they had the capital to pay out a single loss, hence the negotiable percentages involved, as a safe cargo and a safe route would not be seen as a great risk by either party, so it was unlikely the owner would pay a particularly large amount to cover his voyage, but just in case, if the amount was agreeable, they'd probably pay it quite regularly. Conversely, a very risky voyage would usually only be hazarded if there was also a large profit to be made, and thus the owners would be prepared to pay more for their insurance. And the insurers, of course, facing a much greater chance of having to pay out, would certainly be demanding higher premiums. The game was essentially for the owners of the ships and the cargo to try and pay the least amount for insurance in order to maximise their profits, while the insurers tried to make sure that they were charging a percentage rate that was reasonably higher than the likely rate of loss for that kind of merchant shipping. Of course, there were all sorts of terms and conditions about what exactly would be covered, what wouldn't be covered, the standards of proof for meeting these conditions, what counted as an insurable event, what counted as something that would invalidate the policy, and so on and so forth. But luckily for everybody, this isn't a video about the intricacies of financial contract terms and conditions. Instead, we're going to skip forward a couple of centuries from the mid-14th century to the mid-1600s, with a brief period of republicanism governing England. During that time, there were quite significant restrictions on the consumption of alcohol and other similar pleasures that people had frequently enjoyed throughout their day. However, there was also a new drink in London, known as coffee, which at the time was much praised for many supposed health benefits, aside from its ability to keep you quite awake and alert. And thus, the coffee house became popular as a place for people of like mind to gather and discuss matters of the day. The Republican or Commonwealth period ended after just over a decade, and the old distractions of theatres, pubs, taverns, and so forth returned. But the coffee house industry continued to grow as both a good place to meet and do business during the day, as other entertainments, at least for those with money to make, found themselves more and more restricted to later in the day and post-work activities. The Great Fire of London in 1666 also helped, as many people needed somewhere to be during the day while the city and their businesses were rebuilt around them. And building and then running a coffee house was a much quicker and easier thing to do than building and running a theatre and finding people to perform in it, or establishing your own brew house or waiting for a brewery to be completed if you were going to buy from them, and then start making and selling ale and beer. And so it was that by 1688, a man called Edward Lloyd had opened a coffee house on Tower Street, now Great Tower Street, which, unsurprisingly, it was about a stone's throw away from the Tower of London, which is at the eastern end of the City of London. These days, if you're on Great Tower Street, you're about a 2-minute walk away from the north side of the Thames, and you'll come out basically directly opposite HMS Belfast. Being at the eastern end of London and past the fixed bridges that restricted the travel of larger ships further upriver, this part of the city was rife with all things maritime, thus serving as something of an interface between the city itself, which of course thrived on the money and goods brought in by international trade and produced a good many goods which were sent out on said trade, and the docks, warehouses, shipyards, and other facilities that by and large stretched out downriver and of course would continue to grow over time before being completely enveloped by Greater London. Different coffee houses tended to attract different types of client, and this one proved quite popular with both ship owners and captains. And where people engaged in shipping tended to congregate, those who wished to sell them things, including insurance, would gather as well. In 1691, Lloyd moved his coffee house a few roads northwest to Lombard Street. By this point, he clearly had quite a dedicated maritime clientele, as not only were the new premises larger, they were also customised, with a small pulpit installed from which regular announcements were made of news that affected shipping, things like storms, wars, good trade routes, hostile nations, movement of ships, the status and reputation of shipbuilders, and all sorts of other relevant things. Additionally, this pulpit was used to announce the sale or auction of various ships, with the auctions themselves often then subsequently being held at the coffee house. This, of course, became a bit of a feedback loop, something that will feature quite a lot in Lloyd's history. These additional features, such as the auctions, were first tried because, well, people knew there was a large market at that particular coffee house for things like spare ships. And then when these activities became known, they attracted the interest of even more people who had a stake in the maritime industry. And thus the place became even more important if you wanted to sell or buy something to do with trade at sea. And on it went. There was a brief early experiment with publishing a newspaper called Lloyd's News in 1696, but that ended up going nowhere after a few months simply because a general interest newspaper with a slightly random amount of maritime information, the few surviving copies we have indicate that one edition could have as little as 30% maritime information and the next might be 80%, was up against stiff competition from a number of other earlier pre-existing papers which had both a wider audience and a somewhat steadier balance of articles. By the end of the 1600s, though, Lloyd was branching out still further. At this point, England was at war, and to leave the country, you needed a passport. Unlike today, where this is a continuing document that you can just hold on to until you need to travel, back then, it was a very limited document that was granted at specific request for a specific journey. And further, unlike today, you couldn't just apply for one. Someone else of good reputation needed to recommend you. And during this period, the name of Edward Lloyd is recorded as recommending passports for quite a number of merchants who were seeking to head out on various trade voyages, thus making him and his coffee house even more central to general maritime trade in and out of London. Also, in the first decade of the 1700s, we have written evidence not just that the coffee house was acting as a meeting place wherein insurance salesmen already had a ready customer base, but Lloyd himself was acting as a bit of an insurance middleman. At this stage, he's found writing invoices to merchant captains for whom he has secured insurance from other individuals. So essentially what would be happening is that the merchant captain would come in to the coffee house. He would leave an inquiry with Mr. Lloyd, stating what he wanted insured and how much he was willing to pay, and then he would head off on his business, and Lloyd, who obviously was in the premises considerably more, would find the best rate relative to the amount of money that had been left for him as his maximum budget, and he could then invoice the captain in question and make a bit of a profit himself. By the early 1710s, Lloyd's was doing great business, with increasing numbers of auctions being held, and these having expanded from just the occasional ship sale to also include the sale of goods, shares, and services, all roughly related to the maritime industry. But for Lloyd himself, his time in business was nearing an end. Although he was now a wealthy man, he nonetheless died in 1713. With the coffee house and the attendant business, spending the next couple of decades switching hands repeatedly as the inheritors died and their widows or widowers remarried. By the end of the 1720s, Lloyd's Coffee House was in the possession of one Thomas Jemson, who, if you can follow the tortuous line of whole ownership, was the husband of the sister of the second husband of Lloyd's daughter, who had in turn inherited it herself when her own husband, who had previously been the head waiter and had been left the coffee house in Lloyd's own will, had himself died. During this period, the coffee house managed to ride out the South Sea bubble, which actually ended up benefiting Lloyd's quite considerably, even as the rest of the country spiralled into chaos. This was because the economic chaos wiped out a lot of small insurance brokers and companies, and it also forced the government to address the vast amount of fraudulent speculation, bribery, and corruption that characterised the tail end of the South Sea bubble. This resulted in, among other things, royal charters being issued that meant that only the Royal Exchange Assurance Corporation and the London Assurance were now allowed to issue maritime insurance as companies or corporations. A small private individual industry would be allowed to persist, but of course that would be entirely at each individual underwriter's own risk. No other formal insurance companies would be allowed to exist. Now, of course, that might seem like it would be a bad thing for Lloyd's, but remember, Lloyd's was not an insurance company. It was a coffee house where a lot of insurance brokers and underwriters just happened to be. And as it turned out, the two large corporations quickly began to run out of money since they had a company-level monopoly, but it turned out that they were only really good at taking bad risks with other people's money, since, of course, none of their underwriters had their own cash on the line. And soon, after a series of rather significant losses, they moved mostly into other fields of insurance that weren't quite as costly when it all went wrong. Conversely, the private insurers, who were risking their own money, turned out to be far more competitive and cutthroat, and those that survived the bubble began to thrive. These people, of course, needed a place to congregate, and many chose to congregate at Lloyd's. As we've already covered, there was a large existing customer base there, and things began to snowball quite quickly. In 1738, the first edition of Lloyd's List was published, a paper dedicated purely to maritime and shipping news, based in large part on the information that flowed freely through the premises. 292 years later, at the time of writing, it's still being published. The growing importance of Lloyd's can be seen by an example incident from 1740. The country was once again at war, and Admiral Vernon had just managed to capture Portobello. Now, although he had, as most admirals at the time would do, subsequently sent news of his success on via a frigate, the first ship that had received word of the success and then actually reached port in England with the news of the victory happened to be a merchant vessel, whose captain then reported the news to Lloyd's when he went in for his cup of coffee, and Lloyd's, via a representative, was thus the first to bring this welcome news to the government. Essentially, what had happened over the past couple of decades was that private industry had concentrated around Lloyd's as a reliable hub and place to relate not just to their clients, but also to the other underwriters and brokers, as well as allowing them to receive the most up-to-date news, thanks to all the information that flowed through. This feedback loop was encouraged by another loop, one which the Admiralty actually complained about quite a bit. As more and more ships became insured, when convoys were approaching home shores, the captains of insured ships had taken to breaking away from the convoy and beginning solo speed runs to their various destinations. Their aim was to be the first to arrive in port, which would allow them to command the highest possible price for their goods before subsequent ships with similar goods arrived a few days later. Of course, by leaving the protection of the convoy, that left them at risk of being seized by enemy warships or privateers, but the captains were now judging that, well, since that particular risk, financially at least, had been offloaded to somebody else via insurance, and the prospect of additional profit was quite high, it was an attractive course of action to take. This, of course, meant that there was more demand for insurance, as more captains wanted to risk making lots of money, which, being a risky behaviour in and of itself, meant that they had to pay higher premiums, and thus, as long as not too many of them were captured, there was considerably more profit for those sitting in the coffee house underwriting it all. Plus, of course, the insurers could always refuse to insure particularly reckless actions or captains. But with the start of the 1740s, not only did the country become embroiled in a war, this one being the War of Jenkins' Ear, but it marked the start of a period which would only end in 1815, during which Britain would be at war for approximately 60% of the intervening years, with very brief periods of peace between numerous conflicts with practically everybody. This would prove to be a time that would be the making or breaking of Lloyd's, for of course in wartime insurance rates rocket, but so do losses, and thus so do payouts. And so a very slight miscalculation in rates could potentially ruin huge swathes of the industry. And thus it became even more vital to have the latest news of ship movements, who was at war with who, where enemy squadrons were sighted, where the Royal Navy was, what state the Royal Navy was in, and things like this. The widest client base, and therefore the best source of information upon which you could act, meant that there was really only one place that you could go as an insurance underwriter, and that was Lloyd's. And this, of course, gave Lloyd's a considerable interest in the strength and efficiency of the Royal Navy, since it was primarily the country's warships that would make the difference between maritime trade surviving or failing entirely. Lloyd's List also acted as a great stabiliser and a way to chart the fortunes of war, since there were hysterical claims being made left, right and centre by the government, the merchant captains and the enemy regarding exactly how many ships had been captured or lost, whereas with Lloyd's List, its consistent output charting just exactly which ships had seen their policies called in or not after loss or damage showed in perhaps a more reliable light just exactly how good or bad a state the maritime trade situation was in any given year. Lloyd's papers also provide a great way of cutting through propaganda claims on both sides of the various conflicts, both claims made then and claims made more recently, as to who was doing better or worse, since at the end of the day, those whose own money was at stake were quite sensitive to the risks involved on various voyages. And so, if ships heading through areas frequented by one nation or another's warships or privateers attracted higher insurance rates, then it can be assumed, relatively safely, that this area was known to be unsafe and the enemy nation's efforts were being quite effective. Conversely, if insurance rates remained largely unchanged, then no matter the claims of the enemy force operating in the area, they were clearly not particularly effective enough to worry the people whose money was on the line about losing it. Now, that isn't to say it was a steady spiral of ever-increasing profits. In 1762, in the Seven Years' War, during a period when the Royal Navy was actually generally quite dominant on the seas, there was an incident that had the potential to kill Lloyd's outright, when a French squadron happened to slip out of the channel and head over to Canada. On their way, they came across a mass of shipping near the Canadian coast. This consisted of three very large and richly laden convoys, which had come together and combined, but had an almost insultingly small number of escorts. The French squadron was much more powerful than the escorts, and if taken, that combined convoy represented enough insurance policies and thus carried risk to have pretty much wiped out every single broker at Lloyd's. But, for reasons best known only to himself, the French commander decided that his orders, which were to take, or more accurately retake, Newfoundland, simply couldn't wait for any possible reason, and he just sailed past the massed merchant shipping, much to the befuddlement of practically everybody else. Less fortunate, though, was another combined convoy. This was made up of two convoys, totaling 63 merchant vessels, which sailed in 1780. They ran into a massive Franco-Spanish fleet mere days after their Royal Navy escort had been reduced to a single ship of the line and three frigates, shortly after they'd passed the Bay of Biscay. Somewhere to the west of Cape St. Vincent, the escort realised they could do nothing in the face of overwhelming enemy force except for save themselves, and only eight of the merchant ships would escape. The other 55, which included huge amounts of military cargo, would be captured. This single event wiped out somewhere between one-third to one-half of all the insurance brokers operating at Lloyd's. But thanks to its function as an insurance and information hub rather than a direct provider of insurance itself, Lloyd's would survive, as, well, there were still a good number of brokers still in operation, and other new brokers and underwriters came in to occupy the empty tables and booths. Several other heavy blows would fall during this prolonged period of conflict when masses of merchant ships or goods were impounded or captured, including, ironically, one particularly large event where Dutch shipping, which Lloyd's had underwritten to a fairly high degree, was seized by the Royal Navy. But the 1780 disaster would be the single biggest threat that Lloyd's faced during the period. Or at least the biggest external threat. Lloyd's had to survive internal threats as well. In the 1760s, the place was under the management of one Thomas Lawrence, who was by all accounts a terrible manager, and unlike everyone who'd preceded him, had very little interest in actually running the business. He was basically an absentee landlord, and with the end of the latest war and the start of a period of peace, the coffee house became as much a place for speculative gambling on things like which famous person was going to die next, as it was a centre for maritime insurance. And so in 1769, a body of the staff, as well as a number of the brokers and underwriters who were, you know, still interested in the actual maritime insurance business, formed a committee and then left the premises, bouncing around between properties for some years until in 1773 they managed to find a couple of cheap rooms at the Royal Exchange, which would then become the new home of what they styled the New Lloyd's Coffee House. It was here that they would ride out the Great Convoy loss of 1780 and the entirety of the Napoleonic Wars, by the end of which there were just under 1,000 insurance brokers and underwriters, who, thanks to the increasing dominance of the Royal Navy, were making money hand over fist as they were able to charge wartime insurance rates, but were subject to relatively small numbers of payouts compared to previous conflicts, helped by a profitable side branch in insuring privateers, which gave pretty good returns when said privateers made valuable captures, although of course privateering was a little bit of a dangerous business. So successful had Lloyd's become that an 1810 inquiry into maritime insurance monopolies, which technically should have focused primarily on the Royal Exchange Assurance and the London Assurance, the two actual companies allowed to operate in the industry by the Charter of 1720, instead almost entirely looked at the loose collection of insurance men operating in close formation that happened to call themselves Lloyd's. One of the keys to success, given the large numbers of individual underwriters, was that Lloyd's allowed risk to be shared. Instead of one or two people underwriting a voyage, which might have a total value of £50,000, and thus obviously an insurance premium somewhat less than that, which would be the equivalent to insuring a voyage that was worth in the high tens to low hundreds of millions these days, a given policy could be underwritten by many individual Lloyd's members. And if a Lloyd's member didn't like the risks of that particular policy, they were under no obligation to put their name to it. Now, of course, this meant that each individual underwriter would only receive a small share of the premium that was paid, but they were also only liable for a small portion of the risk, amounting to a few hundred pounds at most in most cases, which would be survivable as long as that underwriter had plenty of other policies underwritten and thus plenty of other premiums or portions of premiums coming in. Lloyd's itself kept its doors open and its premises in good condition by charging members £15 to join, and then they paid a subscription of between £2 and £4 a year, depending on what level of subscription they wanted to take. That, of course, allowed you to work on the premises as an underwriter, as there had been an identified issue with so-called gatecrashers coming in, signing on as underwriters to particular insurance schemes, and then vanishing when things went wrong. Part of the general increase in Lloyd's success at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century was also down to its ability to talk to the Royal Navy, both in terms of putting pressure on the Navy to ensure that convoys were well escorted and organised, which in turn could be repaid with favourable insurance rates for Admiralty cargoes, but also their ability to listen to the Royal Navy, as captains and admirals, as well as occasionally having mercantile interests themselves, especially when they were on half pay, would, when they were on active duty, forward names of ships which partook in risky behaviour when in convoys, and those ships or captains might then see their premiums increase or future policies outright refused. thus turning much of the Royal Navy into observation agents for Lloyd's. In the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, Lloyd's would form the Lloyd's Patriotic Fund, which further helped because it granted various awards, both in terms of money and valuables, especially very, very valuable presentation swords, to captains who were particularly noted for their role in safeguarding the merchant trade. So, for example, if you were a captain who by your leadership had managed to save a convoy from enemy attack, you might receive a sword worth £100, which was a lot of money back then and also looked pretty cool, or a collection of silver plate, or in some cases, a pension. But you'd really have to put the boat out for that one. In fact, the single greatest threat to Lloyd's would come not from war, but from the lack of it. With the end of the Napoleonic Wars, insurance rates, of course, had to fall back to peacetime levels, which cut quite heavily into profit margins. And then in 1824, the law, which for over 100 years had restricted maritime insurance to individual underwriters or the two big authorised companies, was repealed. And now Lloyd's would be exposed to competition from other private insurance companies. As soon as the law was amended, many such companies sprang up, covering all sorts of things, including the new industries of the growing industrial revolution, such as railways, canals, deep mines assisted with steam pumps, and more regular kinds of insurance as well, which went alongside growth in the fields of fire insurance and life insurance. And since in the new steam era, a company that was, say, mining coal for sale elsewhere in the country or abroad might need to have insurance against fire, insurance against its machinery breaking down, insurance against flooding in the mines, insurance on its workers' lives, insurance on the railway that transported its coal, and insurance on the ships that transported its coal, plus insurance on the coal itself, some of these insurance companies, aiming to offer a full end-to-end policy, began to offer maritime insurance, thus competing with Lloyd's. All of this combined to send fortunes at Lloyd's tumbling, which was further not helped in the 1830s when the Royal Exchange caught fire and burnt to the ground, taking with it many of Lloyd's records, and leaving them without a permanent home until the Royal Exchange was rebuilt early in the following decade. The organisation was, however, somewhat helped by the institution of the Lloyd's agent system, starting in the late Napoleonic Wars, which allowed Lloyd's to have men positioned in ports across the world, sending in both regular updates on shipping concerns in all corners of the globe, but also allowing them to assess the damage and loss suffered by ships under Lloyd's insurance policies accurately. And they could then offset those losses by various means, which could range from everything from temporary loans to allow the ship to get repaired and back on its journey, and thus back to port where it could sell its cargo and make a profit and thus not call in its full insurance policy, or, if it came down to it, just salvaging what remained of the ship and cargo, and any other valuables, for sale against the cost of the payout. By the middle of the 1800s, Lloyd's branched out into investing in the construction and operation of signal stations to help ensure the smooth flow of maritime trade information in both directions. This goldmine of what was effectively a global maritime intelligence network was largely what allowed Lloyd's to keep its head above water during most of the peacetime 19th century. It simply had far more and far better information from which to make judgments on long-distance international trade than any other insurance company in the world. This also gave them favourable relations with other large services, like the post office, which moved a lot of mail in ships. And in exchange for information and favourable insurance rates, Lloyd's would for decades have a free line of postage via the Royal Mail for those who were sending information and correspondence to them. They were also able to make a fairly healthy side business providing tailored information summaries beyond Lloyd's list to concerned individuals and companies, for a price of course. But despite competition and prolonged peace and thus low premiums, the beginning of rapid merchant expansion that came with the rise of iron ships and steam engines helped Lloyd's immensely. Ships were generally getting safer, but also critically they were getting larger, the square cube law making an appearance as the relative value of the ship compared to the value of the large volumes of cargo they could now carry was slanting more and more in favour of the cargo. And thus, although a single large wreck was more impactful, the sheer value and number of shipments being made began to rise to a point that the overall profitability of insurance also began to rise once more. And of course, the owners of these new, large, valuable ships sought the best information to go with their insurance policies, which of course meant going to Lloyd's, and in the event of a ship hitting a rock or a sandbank, it was also now much more likely that the ship would survive, or at least founder in close waters, which meant there would be even more cargo to recover, thus offsetting the losses further. Of course, a ship sinking out in the middle of the ocean was still a bad thing, but it was happening less frequently. The really big change, though, came in 1871, because in that year, the Lloyd's Committee voted to change the format of the organisation from a society, basically a big club of semi-independent members with a loose degree of governorship, to a corporation. This formalised a huge amount of its activities, as well as in theory giving significantly more power to its committee, and due to the size and nature of Lloyd's and its embedment in the national insurance industry, this change was finally enacted via Parliament as a law and a charter. Now, at this point, Lloyd's shifted somewhat from its previous form, obviously, into its new, more corporate existence, and it would be in this form that it would continue on through the end of the 19th century and then see out two world wars and then run on past that time into an area beyond the time period the Channel covers. But due to the rather significant changes involved with that shift, I'm going to wrap up this video here. And if you'd like a part two looking at the next more corporate 80 years of Lloyd's of London, then let me know in the comments below.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.